When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
The first commandment, you know, is not go forth and preach. The first commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. On that commandment, the whole law depends, as he says so clearly. And I do believe that if we're going to authentically, really, actually, love other people, we will respect them. We will cherish them. We will listen to them. Now, having said all that, we will also tell them what we think is the truth. We will also tell them what we deeply believe is so important for the well-being of humanity, what we have learned in Jesus of Nazareth. We are missionaries. Christians cannot be missionaries. We want to let others know. But if we're loving these people to whom we are witnessing, we will also be ready and open our hearts and minds to let them witness also to us.
My path was clear and straight ahead, but now every day is a
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm Adam Narlock.
And I'm John Williamson.
Oh, my goodness.
And we have news and a killer episode.
You are visibly excited.
I'm super excited because this has been a long time coming. We've been working on it forever. We've been thinking about it, planning for it for since we started. And finally, we have a date.
This is a result of Patreon, by the way.
Absolutely.
110%. Everybody that's supporting us on Patreon, you are bringing the incarnation of deconstruction to your local town.
That's right. So Denver, you are a test market. So no pressure.
The Sunshine State.
But it is all on your shoulders. Sorry. I don't think it's a Sunshine State, is it?
Old school reference.
Is it?
That's an old school movie quote.
Oh. I totally went way over my head.
Luke Wilson is really drunk at that wedding, and he finds out that one person is moving to Denver, and he's like, the Sunshine State.
I forgot about that.
It's a good movie.
Oh, man. We were just talking about Step Brothers. Now we're into old school, so.
There we go.
Denver. So we are coming to, we have a venue, finally locked down. We're finalizing details on that. We've got times, and as of the release of this podcast, we will have tickets.
Yep.
So we want to keep it as cheap as possible, so we figured out
We just got to pay for the room.
Yeah, so we figured out a way to basically cover the room, and that's it. So everything else, anyway. So the Savoy at Curtis Park is where we're doing it. Looks like a really cool venue, and we're going to open the doors a little bit before 7 and go from about 7 to 11. So
it's going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
It is going to be a night of a little bit of content, some stimulation, but mainly just interacting and some kind of structured ways for us all to interact together.
And music.
And it's just going to be freaking beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be so good to be with you guys. Like, that's that's kind of always been our dream, is to just like make conversations happen and be a part of them, and to actually be in a room. Like, I can almost feel the energy right now with people that are coming in just ready to talk, ready to open it up, ready to explore, ready to meet new people, ready to share ideas. Maybe vent a little bit, maybe get some stuff off your chest.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
Yeah, so we're not going to reveal it quite yet, how we're going to structure it, but we have some really cool ideas planned for you guys. And the biggest part is we want to start a conversation that continues long after we leave Denver. And we want to invade your personal space too. So yeah, there's going to really be a lot of hugging.
Yeah,
so
lots of hugging.
I hope you guys are ready for that. So Denver people, if you want to help out, now is the time to start getting the word out. So if you've already seen it up on social media, continue to tell your friends if you live in the area. You know, buy tickets now. Reserve that date. It is April 28th. It's Saturday night. So get your babysitters, you know, plan it, put it on the calendar, invite as many friends as you can, because again, Denver, this is on your shoulders. So if this fails miserably, we may never do this again.
Mm.
So
it is not going to fail miserably.
No.
Because it's you guys that are going to make this fun, exciting, special, cool, unique, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, like back in the old days when your parents used to, you know, tell you, you know, why aren't you inviting your friends to church? And you're just like, because it's weird and I don't know. There's, I can't do it. You have like no excuse now. It's like, there's going to be music. It's at like a really cool space. And we're going to have conversations that anybody can be a part of, no matter what walk of life you're from. Deconstruction and the whole idea, like the positive spin that we think we bring to deconstruction, is like good for anybody,
yeah,
and everybody. So that's what we're bringing to the Denver area, and we are excited.
Yeah. So if you're into spirituality or religion or whatever, or even if you're not, like, we want to create a safe space, just like we do with the podcast here. We want to create that live. So again, tell your friends. You know, bring people, you know, friends, family members with you, whatever, and share it on social media. So it'll be out on social media. Again, it's April 28th. It's that Saturday evening at the Savoy at Curtis Park. It's going to be super cool. Like I said, we'll be talking about it all over the place on social media leading up to the event. So
yeah, we're really stoked. So thank you for Denver. Thank you to Denver, all of you in Denver, for really inviting us to your city.
Yeah.
And making us feel like you want us there.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And we're stoked.
Thank you to all the people who have reached out and offered to help spread the word. You guys are amazing. If we haven't gotten back to you, hang tight. We will get back to you. We're still catching up on emails.
Yep. So. And now, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen. There are so many little tasty treats that we think we've brought you over the years. And oftentimes, John and I really, really enjoy bringing the lesser known but the absolute titan guests that, like, maybe you just didn't know about.
Yeah.
Maybe you just didn't know about this person or this kind of, you know, vein of research or work or whatever. For some of you, that might have been like Tad DeLay last week. It's like, didn't know about him, and now you're like, oh my gosh. Or like Pauline Boss. I feel like a lot of people were like, how did I miss this lady? This is gold. This is another one.
Yeah.
Who do we got this week?
So this is Paul F. Nitter. He's the Paul Tillich Professor of Theology, World Religions, and Culture at Union Theological Seminary in the city of New York, and Professor Emeritus of Theology at Xavier University here in Ohio. This guy is a guy that I was really excited about getting because he was one of the pioneers of one of the models of theologies of religions. So when we had our series on religious pluralism, he's one of the guys that really pioneered one of those models. And how do we find grace potentially in other religions? Mm. And so
good.
We've read a couple of his books, Know Their Name, and one of the books that Adam has been binge reading lately, and I'm so pumped about
it. So good, man. Without Buddha, I could not be a Christian. And honestly, guys, this is one of those books that if what we're doing on this podcast space is resonating with you, this is kind of one of those must reads. Without Buddha, I could not be a Christian. Kind of just a tongue-in-cheek title. He kind of explained, this is like a autobiography of his deconstruction starting in the 70s and finding a lot of kind of problems with the language we use in religion and some of the ideas that we're so dogmatic about. and how learning from other people actually just enriched his own faith. And that there's nothing that could be more true to what we think is like the positive side of deconstruction than compassionate listening and widening who you are and where you are by doing a really good job listening to people that are not like you. And so this book, Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian, guys, it's freaking awesome. It's so good.
One cool note, one cool fact that you mentioned earlier before we started recording, he studied under one of like the godfathers.
Oh man, Vatican II architect, Karl freaking Rahner. And if you don't know who Karl Rahner is, it's okay. We're not going to shame you. You should stop what you're doing right now, unless you're driving, that is, and Google Karl Rahner and be one of the people that's in the know at this point. Because Karl Rahner is one of those guys that if you like this kind of stuff, you got to read some Karl Rahner. We can't interview him because he's dead.
Right.
Kind of same deal with Tillich. Same deal with John O'Donohue, who I'm reading right now. There's just so many beautiful dead people.
I know.
But Karl Rahner is he's a titan. He's absolutely amazing. And this guy studied under him, and he holds the Tillich chair.
I mean, come on.
In New York.
That's not a mashup.
I mean, come on, man. This guy is, and when you hear this interview, which we'll get to right now, he's so warm. He's so loving. He's so intelligent.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just one of those episodes where John and I just kept looking at each other when we were recording it going, is this happening? This is so good.
Yeah. Oh, man. What a treat.
So much fun. Well, without further ado, I mean, we should just get right to this.
Well, I mean, I think we need to point this out before we go, though. His middle initial, he does go by Paul F. Nitter. We're just going to assume that stands for freaking.
It has to. It must.
Yeah.
So, yeah, without further ado, we give you Paul freaking Nitter. All right, well, Dr. Paul Nitter, it is just a real honor and I really, really appreciate you making time to be on the Deconstructionist podcast tonight and talk about all kinds of different things about religion and all your work there, being Paul Tillich Professor of Theology at Union Theological Seminary. So thank you for being with us.
I'm very happy to be with you. A real privilege and opportunity. Thank you.
So for those of our listeners who aren't as familiar with maybe your work, I have several of your books at this point that I came across that I absolutely love. Obviously, the big work being No Other Name, and of course, came across even more of your work through some of the classes that I took in seminary. If you could just give a brief overview of who you are and what you do specifically and the specific kind of work that you're involved in.
Okay, and I'll try to keep it short, but also to make it a bit personal. You know, we were talking about just how this whole relatively new area of Christian theology, namely a theology of religions, how can Christians make sense of other religions, is the main topic of this branch of theology, how it got started. I say it's relatively new, and in a sense, my own life kind of embodies the development of this field of theology. So if I can just get a little bit personal here, I think it might be helpful. I grew up and still as a Roman Catholic, and I still am a Roman Catholic, a struggling Roman Catholic, as I think many Roman Catholics are. But I was born way back in 1939 and in the old Catholic Church, so that's before the Second Vatican Council. And I decided after already in eighth grade that I wanted to be a priest, and not just a priest, but a missionary priest. In other words, I wanted to go out to train myself to go out and convert other people's to the gospel and to the Christian church. Of course, that you know, for Catholics at that time, the Christian Church meant the Catholic Church. But anyway, I embody what I think was a general attitude of many Christians, if not most Christians, namely that if you weren't in the Christian Church, you were going to have a heck of a, dare I say, hell of a hard time avoiding hell. in other words, there is no, as the statement that goes way back to the early church, to St. Cyprian, declares, outside the church, there is no salvation. And that was pretty much taught by most of the Christian churches. And so, and I believed it. I believed it deeply. And since I loved all these people in other religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, since I loved them, I wanted to go out and save them because I felt that if they did not convert, you know, to the Christian church, they would be lost. So that's how I started. And I started with what would be called today in the theology of religions, a kind of an exclusivist attitude, an exclusivist theology of other religion. They were excluded as ways of finding God. Well, I started my training in the seminary, and part of that training was start studying and reading about these other religions. You have to know the people you're going to try to convert. But also, we had a lot of talks from missionaries returning from the missionary fields in Japan, in Indonesia, in India, in New Guinea, in Ghana, in Togoland, as it was called then. And the more I studied and the more I learned about these other religions, you know, they didn't look so bad. You know, or there seemed to be a lot of good in them. And we used to say a prayer in the seminary. By the way, I was studying to become a priest in the Society of the Divine Word. It's still a very active missionary order in the Catholic Church. We used to pray every day, three or four times a day, actually, may the darkness of sin and the night of hedonism vanish before the light of the Word and the Spirit of grace. So the darkness of sin and the night of hedonism was what you find in other religions. But as I said, the more I learned about these other religions, it didn't seem to be only darkness or only sin. So I was struggling. What was my work as a missionary? And then, I mean, how God works in providential ways, I was at a point in my seminary studies where I was going to begin my theological studies, the last 4 years of training, last 4 years of 14 years of preparation for ordination to the priesthood, I was sent to Rome to study my theology. That was back in 1962. It was a great opportunity to study in Rome. But not only that, just to be in Rome, I landed in Rome. I arrived in Rome in September of 1962, at the end of the month. 2 or 3 weeks later, on October 11th, 1962, I still remember the day, the Second Vatican Council began. I had the privilege of standing in the Piazza of St. Peter's, the square of St. Peter's, when Pope John the 23rd led some 2,200 bishops into the cathedral to start the Second Vatican Council. And that was an experience in itself, being in Rome during those 3 years of the council. But now here's what the point I'm getting to. One of the statements in that council, the Second Vatican Council, a statement called in its Latin title, Nostra Aetate, in our age, was a statement on the attitude of the Catholic Church towards what they called non-Christian religions. And John and Adam, I couldn't believe what I read in that statement back in 1965, where the Catholic Church said that there is good and there are value in other religions, that God is working in other religions. Mm. And then they added, and that Christians are called upon to dialogue with other religions.
Wow.
So this was for me just an enlightenment, a liberation, as it were, from a kind of a negative exclusivist theology to an inclusivist theology. Now, that's another model that developed there, you know, especially at the Second Vatican Council, but through the years right after that, I won't go into this, but the World Council of Churches followed through with much of the same call for dialogue with other religions. So it was, you know, both Catholic and Protestant churches were opening themselves up to recognize the possible presence of God in other religions. And so, but it was an inclusivist model, and by that it was meant that they affirmed, this new theology affirmed the presence of God and the working of God and the possibility of learning, you know, from these other religions. But it also was inclusivist in that it stated that, however, the fullness of truth and the final truth was contained in Christianity, in the gospel, in the revelation given to all humankind in Jesus Christ. And so all of these good things in other religions, this council called, if I use the Latin, it's so clear, a preparatio evangelica, a preparation for the gospel. Mm. So the good was there, but it was meant to prepare them to become Christians. Now, for me at that time, though, that was still a liberation. But as the years have gone on, I and other Christians struggling to try to figure out the main question, well, if we're called to dialogue with other religions, that dialogue means really opening ourselves and trying to meet on a common ground so that we can really learn from each other, each of us making the claims of truth that we feel God or our ultimate reality has given us. But how can you have a real dialogue if your intent is to absorb the other religion into yourself, to make everybody Christians. In other words, to remove, ultimately, all these other religions and make them all Christians. Mm. And that was a point I and so many others have been struggling with. And over these years, and this is what I was trying to get at in that book you mentioned, No Other Name. By the way, that title had a question mark behind it. No Other Name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How are we Christians to understand the you know, that text from the Acts of the Apostles, there is no other name given to humankind by which they can be saved except the name of Jesus. How are we to understand this in the world of many religions? And we have been, so many other Christian theologians have been developing proposing and exploring what is called like a third model, a third kind of theology of religions, which is called more of a pluralistic understanding of religions, where it recognizes that each religion can have, and in the case of Christianity, we're speaking out of our own faith, does have truth that God intends for all human beings. It is saving truth for everyone. But we now open our minds and our hearts to the possibility that God may be offering God's truth and God's presence. And God, that means God's grace.
Mm.
Also, in other religions, a grace and a truth that may be also important, if not necessary, for other religions. So that just as we Christians know for sure, excuse me if I'm speaking as a Christian to Christians, I know all your listeners may not necessarily be Christians, but just speaking to my fellow Christians, while we Christians, you know, from our own experience and our own lives, know that in our faith, our trust in our faith, that God has spoken in Jesus, if you're a pluralist Christian, you're also open to the fact of being surprised by the Holy Spirit, by what the Holy Spirit may be saying to us in Buddha, or in Muhammad, or in Mao Tzu, and to see what we might learn. And that's been the path I've been pursuing. This is a little bit long-winded here, but it's kind of, so I grew up in the exclusivist model. You know, I was liberated in the Second Vatican Council by the inclusivist model of theology, of religion. And now I have been trying carefully, respectfully, I hope, in developing what is called a pluralist theology of religions. And by the way, I'll just add, this would be another topic, in my own dialogue with other religions, I have found that it is especially Buddhism that has challenged me.
Mm.
If I may put it this way, it is especially Buddhism where I find the Holy Spirit speaking to me.
Mm.
And so I try to figure out just what I learned from Buddhism a couple of years back when I first retired from teaching at Xavier University in Cincinnati. That's before I moved on to Union Theological Seminary. I wrote a book with the title, it's a little bit of a you might say a racy title, but it's an honest title. It's a sincere title. Without Buddha, I could not be a Christian.
Mm.
I have found that Buddhism has so enriched my Christian life that I can't imagine following Jesus without also listening to Buddha.
Mm.
Anyway, that's kind of the three models, and kind of more in my own personal life and searching as a Christian, and how they've been expressed in my own life.
Man, you just didn't give us anything to go on there. That was wonderful.
Oh, man.
Fantastic.
And to prove to my college professor that I did learn something along the way, I was like, yep, okay, I know which model he's talking about, so this is good. But
oh, dude, John, the smile on your face.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, I just find this topic to be so interesting and to discover it and not realize that this was even a topic of study that even existed was just like opening a treasure trove of information for me. So I think the good place to start was you've kind of gone over some of the models already, and I was just kind of looking over my notes here. So you talk about potentially four models within your books: the replacement model, the fulfillment model, the mutuality model, the acceptance model. I wondered if you could for people listening, I think it'd be really interesting to kind of give a high level overview of what do each of those mean, and where do you find yourself currently? Which model have you done the most work in that you feel kind of answers the question most satisfactorily?
Yeah, right. So those models that I described in that book, Introducing Theologies of Religions, that you're referring to, I have given my own names to the three models I mentioned earlier. So the replacement model is really just a synonym for what I earlier called in this conversation, the exclusivist model. Mm. That's the model that believes that not only outside of Christ, outside of Jesus, there is no salvation. It affirms that, because there are some Christians who believe that because of the death and resurrection of Jesus, God's grace has been given to all people.
Mm-hmm.
This model, the replacement model, says, no, you have to have express contact through the preached word with the message of Jesus, and you have to make a choice of accepting that message. Otherwise, you're not going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot be saved. That's the replacement model. The fulfillment model is my word for the inclusivist model. Says no. So the replacement model says there's only one true religion, and it's Christianity. The fulfillment model, also called inclusivist model, says no. There may be many true religions. In other words, God is working in many religions. This was the message of the Second Vatican Council that I mentioned earlier. But there are many true religions, but one of them is the best. One of them contains the fullness of truth, and that is Christianity. And that, to be honest with you, that model is the fulfillment model, is the, if I may put it this way, the kind of the official model, the accepted model within the Roman Catholic Church. It's this one that's taught by, has been taught by the Vatican sources and the papal teachings. But it is also the dominant model within what we can call the mainline churches.
Mm-hmm.
That is the World Council, the churches of the World Council of Churches. And then the third model that I mentioned was the mutuality model, which is another word, a synonym for the pluralist model. This says, no, there can be truth in many religions. So there are many true religions, and no one religion can claim to have the fullness of truth about God and the final word of truth about God. What they have to do is live in mutuality. They have to learn from each other. They have to be in dialogue. That would be the mutuality model. Now, a fourth model, which I had not mentioned earlier, you know, is more of a recent development. When I say recent, I'm an old timer, so recent can mean that over the past 20, 25 years, is what is called the acceptance model. And that is the model. This comes out of more of a philosophical, maybe even anthropological perspective, where it says that all of our cultures are so different. First of all, they say two things. They say every time anything we know, we human beings, anything we know is always conditioned by, influenced by, our culture, the context in which we've been brought up with. No one can see the truth, as it were, without glasses. We're all wearing cultural glasses. We always see the truth through our glasses. And so what I see through my cultural glasses, my American, in my case, Catholic cultural glasses, is going to be different from what a Japanese Buddhist sees through his Asian Japanese Buddhist glasses. So that's what they say. And so we're really different. We're really, really different. And then they say the second thing, and these differences are so great that really an American Catholic cannot really understand a Japanese Buddhist, you know, just to give an example.
Right.
And therefore, we should just accept the fact that we're all different and be nice to each other and our differences. Don't fight with each other. Recognize that we're all, you know, trying to be human in our different ways. And let's just get along. It's kind of like a good neighbor, a religious good neighbor policy. But, you know, we all live behind our own fences, you know, our own religious fences. I have a Christian fence. Japanese have a Buddhist fence, Chinese have a Confucian fence, and that's, you know, that a Muslim fence. That can be the case not just between the United States and China or Arabia. It's right here in Chicago and Philadelphia and New York. We have these different religions. But with this model, the acceptance model says, stay inside your own fence. Be nice to each other across the fence, but don't try to... convert each other, but don't even try to learn from each other, because just be nice to each other. Mm. And that's a fourth model. It's a more recent development, as I said, called the acceptance model. Let's just accept each other.
November cold to keep us warm, and the bottles keeping it alive, still alive.
So out of those models, obviously you've done a lot of work within the mutuality model, and one of the guys who I discovered who I really enjoy, who was influential in Vatican II, Karl Rahner, it seems did a lot of work with the fulfillment model, but it seems, and if I understand this correctly, I think you were a student of his, is that right?
Yes, I had the privilege of studying with Father Rahner. in Münster, and at the University of Münster in Germany.
Unreal.
Back at the end of the 60s. Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible.
Wonderful opportunity. It was wonderful opportunity.
So I think it'd be fair to say that you've kind of gone beyond the work that he even did. He kind of took things a little further, kind of pushed the church.
And I know, and this is always, you know, you want to respect your teacher, but I really felt that Father Rahner and was so influential in the Second Vatican Council, but he still held that. And as do so many Christians, let's be honest here, and I want to be respectful of that, but he still held that ultimately God would, because God has given God's fullest revelation in Jesus, in the incarnate word of Jesus that we find in Jesus of Nazareth, that we encounter in Jesus of Nazareth, because of that, that's the fullness of revelation. And while these people in other religions, Buddhists, Hindus, Christians, they can be saved by being good Buddhists and good Muslims and good Hindus, still, Rahner felt that ultimately God wants them all to become Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my take on that is that, and maybe we can talk a little bit about this.
Yeah.
The more I understand of the teachings of Jesus, and the more I try in my always limited way, both as a Christian believer and as a professional theologian, to understand the gospel, the more I find that we Christians, if we really want to take Jesus seriously and understand him, would recognize that that I don't know if Jesus wanted everyone necessarily, you know, to join his team. I mean, I think his primarily he wanted the members of his team, his followers, Christians, you know, to the first and foremost obligation, if you want to put it that way, we have towards others.
Yeah.
Is, you know, I don't, is to love them.
Mm.
That's the primary. The first commandment, you know, is not go forth and preach. The first commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. On that commandment, the whole law depends, as he says so clearly.
Mm.
And I do believe that if we're going to authentically, really, actually love other people, we will respect them.
Mm.
We will cherish them. We will listen to them. Now, having said all that, we will also tell them what we think is the truth.
Right.
We will also tell them what we deeply believe is so important for the well-being of humanity, what we have learned in Jesus of Nazareth. We are missionaries. Christians cannot be missionaries. We go forth and we want to let others know. But if we're loving these people to whom we are witnessing, we will also be ready and open our hearts and minds to let them witness also to us.
Mm.
Recognizing always, as Jesus put it, if I may refer to this from John's Gospel, that the Father is greater than I. The Father is greater than all of us, both beyond anything we can know. God's ultimate truth, all religions, I think, nowadays you're not supposed to ever say all, but in this case, darn it, I will. All religions recognize that what they are after, or what they feel they have experienced, whether they call it God, or whether they call it Nirvana, or whether they call it Brahman, or whether they call it the Tao, or whether they call it Allah, they all recognize that is a mystery that is beyond anything human beings can fully comprehend.
Mm.
God is always greater. God is always more. Now, that doesn't in any way deny that we can know something of God. we do, thanks to, for us Christians, thanks to Jesus.
Right.
As well as to the beauties of creation and such. It's not just Jesus.
Right.
But we know, in a sense, the deeper we go into an experience of God, and in our case as Christians, the deeper we go into an experience of the God of Jesus, the more we know at the same time that this God transcends everything that we can ever know. That this God is always going to be a God of further truth and deeper truth and greater surprises. And especially if you take, you know, Jesus' teaching on the Holy Spirit, when he said the Holy Spirit's going to come, he's going to, the Holy Spirit's going to teach even greater things than you may have heard from me. You know, if we take that seriously, I think we have to be open to others. And so, you know, I'm still a missionary, in a sense, but I understand a missionary, and I'm really very proud to say that the Society of the Divine Word that I was part of, by the way, I forgot to mention in my whole, you know, I was ordained a priest, but then, and was a priest for 9 years, and then made the difficult decision that that I left the priesthood, and then eventually got married, and then went on to be able to teach theology. But I'm still very connected with the Society of the Divine Word, and I'm very happy to say that they are one of the many missionary orders now. I can speak for Catholic, the missionary orders in the Catholic Church. I don't know that much about missions, mission theology of Protestant churches, but they understand missionary work as, this is their one sentence definition of missionary work today. To be a missionary is to engage in prophetic dialogue. To be a missionary is to engage in prophetic dialogue. By dialogue, that means we go out to do what you have to do to have a dialogue, to tell others what you think is the truth, to listen to what they think is the truth, and to try to grow together. But the Society of the Divine Word adds prophetic dialogue, namely, we are speaking out of the prophetic message of Jesus Christ. And that message is a message that is meant to both inspire as well as to upset us in what God really calls us to do. So missionary work is prophetic dialogue. We go out to witness and to be witnessed to challenge and to be challenged. So I think, I mean, for me, that seems to really sustain a very, you know, to sustain a deep commitment to Christ and to the gospel and to our Christian identity. I say that because a lot of people say, "Oh, if you're a pluralist or a mutualist, you are giving up on the gospel." Heck, no!
I love it, Paul. Let me ask you a question. There's something you said that really, really sparked some interest for me. So much of this is going to be so good because I think a lot of the reasons that people might be finding themselves listening, maybe even in the closet a little bit to like, you know, the Deconstructionist podcast is because they feel uncomfortable with a lot of the more overly structured, overly authoritative, maybe overly fundamentalist religion that maybe they've had, or maybe there was, you know, some kind of thing that sparked them to start to look into other views and really start to question and give voice to some of their doubts. And they find themselves here, and your work is incredibly important for that that area, because so many people just want to know, you know, what about other religions? And so much of this is so germane to what so many people are wondering and have felt for so long, maybe even ashamed to wonder or guilty because they're wondering this stuff. But specifically, something that you said is something that's come up on this podcast from time to time. And it's a question, you know, speaking about our religion versus their religion, and you kind of always going back to talking about Jesus and, you know, what was Jesus really after? And the more you get into Jesus, the more you actually see that, you know, maybe some of this stuff that we have isn't exactly what he would have even taught. The question I want to ask is, do you think that Jesus was even trying to establish another religion? You know, when we think of religion in terms of tribalism, indoctrination, assimilation, conquering, swallowing up other religions. You know, they're usually attached to the state or to the nation. They're usually working in the same power structures as other religions. And it seems like a lot of the things that Jesus said and did left us all wondering, you know, when you'd say things like, you know, destroy this temple. You know, not one stone's going to be left on another. And, you know, I've not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And, you know, a lot of even the conversations in the New Testament had some of the disciples wondering, like, what do we even do now? Do people need to follow the law? Like, do we need to circumcise? Like, do we go, well, what do we do now? Like, was he even trying to establish another religion? I honestly don't know.
Yeah, no, that's very, very important question. And from what, you know, and I'm not a New Testament scholar, although I really try to read as much as I can of books by New Testament scholars. And I think it is generally recognized today that from what we can know of the, you know, what is called the historical Jesus, from as much as we can really try to get back to what was the kind of the original vision and message of Jesus before it was, you know, tailored, you know, and adapted to the Greek Roman culture as the apostles moved into the Roman Empire out of Palestine. From what we can tell, Jesus was not against religion, but he did not want to found a new religion.
Mm.
I think he was like so many of his fellow of his, you know, the line of prophets in Israel in the history of Judaism.
Yeah.
He wanted to purify his own religion.
Yeah.
And so the quote that you made, you know, I did not come to abolish the law. You know, he did not want to. So the practices in the temple, you know, the laws as they were understood, he affirmed those, but he wanted, I mean, what he wanted was for people not to get hung up on the practices of religion, but to make them the end. But he saw religion as a means to an end, And what was that end? To come to this deep, I dare say, mystical experience of God as love, of God as, and this God who is holding us, is part of us, is always present to us. This God who even calls us, you know, to love those people who hate us, because God in God's self loves even sinners, the people who seem to hate God, that we are called, you know, to have that kind of a deep personal, more prayerful, contemplative experience of this God, the kind of experience that he was opening himself to when he wanders off into the desert and takes time out off to go up by himself to pray. You know, the God that he was getting in contact with right before the Romans caught him and were about to execute him in the Garden of Gethsemane. I mean, those mystical moments, you know, are, I think, what Jesus was calling us, you know, to do. But in other words, if I may put it in some jargon that we throw around today, he was calling people primarily to be spiritual by being religious.
That's, you know, good.
I don't think Jesus was saying being spiritual and not religious.
Right.
No, but he wanted them to be spiritual, to find this deep spirituality in their religion, feeling that's what religion, the purpose of religion is, to lead us to this deep spirit. So I think, to answer your questions, he didn't want to found a new religion, but he did want to deepen the spiritual potential of his own religion, this beautiful Jewish religion. Without going into it, we know from history that just given the history, the Jesus followers right after the resurrection were all basically Jews. And for many years, they thought that to be a good Jesus follower, you had to be a Jew. And then, you know, Paul and Peter, you know, had arguments about that. And we see that as things developed, the Jesus followers went their own way. They call it like the parting of the ways. That's how one scholar put it. So the Jesus followers became Christians. They weren't Christians in the beginning. And the followers of the Mosaic revelation, called the Torah, continued to be their own religion. And we had the separation of the religions. Ask the theologian the question, and you never get a short answer.
This is not a space for short answers, Paul. Short answers here.
I would appreciate a few yes or no's, though.
sure. We're too busy enjoying your answers, so.
So I think what you're saying, to kind of maybe sum it up in my own words, Jesus wasn't looking to use religion to be religious, and he also wasn't looking to make people spiritual and not religious. He was looking to show people religion as a means of being truly spiritual.
Yes, you said it very well. Yes, that's what I believe. And I think, I think the majority of scholars would endorse that.
Oh, I love that. I think there's an awakening right now of people starting to, we even had this guy on the show recently, his name is Zach Hoag, and he wrote this really great book recently called The Light is Winning. And his, after deconstruction, he really came to a place where he's like, this is good stuff. Like, religion is a beautiful means to mysticism and to experience of God and his love, which, orients us towards the other. And all of this ancient, wonderful, beautiful stuff, like, it's beautiful. It's wonderful. And there's some revitalization going on right now.
Right. I think a lot of it comes under, different rubrics or titles. But one of them is talked about now is under the rubric of the emergent church.
Yes.
Yeah. The movement of the emergent church. I think that's what we're getting at. Or kind of in other aspects, just more of a contemplative kind of Christianity.
Absolutely.
With a stress on centering prayer and things like that. Which is using Christian tradition
totally
to bring us to a more personal, a more contemplative, I like the word mystical, experience of our unity with God.
Beautiful.
You know, John's gospel is so clear. I and the Father are one, and you are one in us. As I am one with the Father, so you are one with me, and we are both one with the Father. My heavens. That is heavy duty, beautiful mysticism,
Yes.
Yeah.
It's what's interesting, I think fascinating for us as the very fortunate, lucky hosts of this podcast is that what we're finding is that a lot of folks, not just younger, the younger folks, but like people of all ages who are kind of re-engaging and re-experiencing a life of faith, are doing so in a way that is beyond just this narrow path that they were originally on, perhaps. And so it's very interesting to watch because they're pulling in Protestant theologians, they're pulling in Catholic theologians. One of our favorite guests and one of the more popular theologians, authors out there right now is like Father Richard Rohr. He was a Franciscan monk.
Oh, yes.
And so... Mm-hmm. So not just are we seeing this explosion of searching within our own Protestant roots and looking at things that are written within that context, but people are looking into Catholic theology for the first time. If that's not their
perennial tradition,
yes, going back to the early church fathers, looking at other religions, and exploring outside of those contexts. So it's been a very interesting thing to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, that's been in my own life, as I just mentioned earlier that it's been exploring other religions, particularly Buddhism, that has just given me so many opportunities to deepen my own Christian spirituality.
Mm. So I think this would be a good spot to talk about. So we've identified these various models as a means to kind of answering that bigger question. You know, can grace be attained or found in other religions and that sort of thing? So let's look at some of the roadblocks, some of the issues that people encounter when trying to make sense of this. And so one of the questions that I think kept coming back around in my course when I was studying this, you know, the theology of religions was the idea of the uniqueness of Christ specifically for Christians. That obviously is something people keep running into. And so you talk about in your work this idea of the theocentric Christology. That's obviously
that's a mouthful.
That's a big phrase right there. I wondered if you could break that down, because I thought this was a really fascinating concept.
Right. You know this whole encounter with other religions and trying to make sense not only of other religions but of our own beliefs, our own Christian beliefs, in the light of other religions. It's another opportunity for, you know, to face the question that Jesus, posed to his disciples: "Who do you say I am? Who do you say I am?" You know, and that's a question that we have to keep asking and answering anew as the churches grow and as history moves forward and as we have different experiences. So, anyway, yes, a theocentric Christology. another example of some of the complicated phrasing that theologians use. What I and others, have learned and are trying to express is that, again, going back to the Gospels, when we look at the message of Jesus, he was not self-centered.
Mm.
You might say he was not Christ-centered, Christocentric. He was Abba-centered, mm-hmm. but he called God his Father.
Yep.
He was God-centered. What counted most was not who he was, but who God was. Now, having said that, and I think that's fundamental, he also believed that he had experience. He had been given to experience God in such a way that he saw aspects of God. He understood God in such a way that he felt it was important for others also to understand. In other words, he was saying that I want us all to be centered on God, but in order to be centered on God, I think I have something vitally important to say. So you see, it was God-centered, but through Jesus. I mean, through himself, he had a message. So I and others.
Yeah.
We're trying to develop a Christology, an understanding of Christ that would be not focused primarily or exclusively on Jesus, but on the message of Jesus. And the message of Jesus, as I just said, had to deal with the reality of God and what Jesus experienced, and he got this from his Jewish background. He saw that God was up to something in human history.
Mm.
God wanted to achieve something in history through us. And for him, for Jesus, the key symbol, I say symbol, the key image, the key word that he used to get at what he felt God was up to was, as it has been translated into the Greek of the New Testament, which is, you know, the language of the New Testament, the Basileia tou Theou, the reign of God.
Mm.
The kingdom of God. And this, and again, New Testament scholars says this was the key, the center of Jesus' message. He came to announce not just God, but the reign of God. And the reign of God, again, we could say, what did he mean by the reign of God? Much can be said about that. But it was basically that he saw that he used this image of the reign. That's a social image. The reign, the kingdom, the commonwealth. You know, one theologian translates the Greek word basileia as commonwealth, the commonwealth of God, as a way of people living together in the world, in a society in which all of them experience the God who calls, who loves them, and who calls them to love each other. And to address especially the needs of people, the Anawim, the Hebrew for the poor, the people of the earth, the people who have been excluded, the people who have been enslaved. So you cannot love God and love your neighbor unless you are also working for justice for yourself as well as for your neighbors who have been stepped on. And so this is the heart of Jesus' message. So it's not, you might even say, the way I try to put it in more recent writings, is that Jesus was not Christocentric. And in a certain sense, you might say he was not theocentric, God-centered. He was, using the Latin word, regocentric. He was kingdom-centered. He was reign-centered. Mm. That's what counted most. And so to follow Jesus means that you are working primarily with yourself, with your community, and with others to establish this reign of God, this way of living in the world in which human beings can truly care about each other and can offset all the causes of injustice and suffering due to injustice. Mm. And to follow Christ means to work for that goal. And where you will see others, whether they are Hindus or Buddhists or Muslims or even atheists, who are working for a world of greater love and care and justice, hey, let's work with them. Let's put our shoulder to shoulder and let's learn from each other. So I think that's kind of I'm in my own life, in my own faith, in the way I try to live out my Christian life in relation to other religions, that's what it means for me to follow Christ. Mm. And it's kind of summarized in this beautiful, simple sentence by a good friend, fellow theologian of mine, a friend of mine, John Cobb.
Oh, yeah.
Who says, Jesus is the way that is open to other ways. Jesus is the way that is open to other ways. So if you want to follow this way of Jesus, you have to do so in an openness to, in an engagement with people who are different than you, from you, people who are following other ways, so that all of us can work more towards what Jesus called the reign of God. A reign of peace and justice, of compassion and justice, and where you have compassion and justice, you will have peace.
Lord, if these are your children, why don't they look like you? And I read somewhere that what you've done at least to these.
Yeah. So
good.
Yeah, that's kind of what
we're dropping. We're dropping.
Keep me going.
We're dropping mics. We're dropping mics over here on your behalf.
that was beautiful.
That was such a beautiful thing to say. I have a question that it's kind of an observation that I'm going to try to turn into a question and just get you to kind of riff on a little bit. So one of the things that I've noticed is, you know, in all these models that we've kind of talked about and when, you know, ways we engage with other people of the world when we've, you know, experienced some sort of identification with a world religion, with, you know, specifically Christianity, and we want to engage with people in the world, even if it's just in our imagination. You know, I think of, you know, the high school student or the college student thinking for the first time, what about all those people that never heard? You know, and, you know, we're all, yeah. you know, in some way, shape, or form, whether it's on the ground, you know, by car, by plane, engaging with other cultures, or even if it's just in a textbook or in our imagination, we're engaging with cultures. And that's why this conversation is so important. So one of the things that I think I've noticed is that there, we have all these models and we need all these models, but in this, there's this presupposition. And it seems to me that in order for the traditional model, that it's only Christianity and that only functions in a very specific way with very specific language and very specific guidelines, mm-hmm. and it has to be done, you know, you got to have your I's dotted and your T's crossed, but oh, by the way, it's all by grace, which that, you know, is a problem even there. But
yeah.
in that, one of the biggest problems I have is I've noticed, do we caricaturize other people groups and other religions as overly pagan or dark or, you know, problematic in order to maybe bolster or exaggerate Christianity as the solution? I feel like we need to, in hearing you talk about your experience with Buddhism, I've had similar experiences. When you engage, we did a pluralism series on our podcast, and when you engage and you actually sit down and talk with somebody from a people group and a religion and a perspective, be it Hindu, Islam, Buddhist, Jewish, atheist, whatever, and you just listen to them, one of the first things that I start to think about is, oh my gosh, I am so guilty of overly caricaturizing your perspective in order to make my solution look more like a solution. And even like the etymology of like the word heathen, you know, we have, you know, it's people on the heath and, you know, on the fringes of society, the edges, you know, all out there has this sort of, it suggests an inferiority. And I wonder, you know, why it doesn't seem to fit with what you see when you read the Gospels and you see the way Jesus interacts with people. And yeah. Where did this start to happen? Because you don't even really see it much in the New Testament. Like, why do we always feel the need to why do we always feel the need to overly caricaturize and downplay and exaggerate and make these kind of straw man arguments all these people? It's just an observation that I have. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's an important and a deep question, and I don't have a neat or a definitive answer. But you know, I think part of it is there's a certain psychological orientation that we all bear as human beings that may have been determined by our the way we have evolved and natural selection and such, where we kind of as a book I'm just reading now puts it, by the way, a really good book on Buddhism by a guy by the name of Robert Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, Why Buddhism is True. Anyway, he talks about how we've been kind of just genetically disposed to think that we are more special than others.
Yeah.
And just in order to carry on with the gene pool and all that. You know, I question some of the all too clear assertions of how things evolve. Anyway, but there is this whether it's psychological or even biological orientation to make ourselves special in order to carry on with our contribution to the gene pool or whatever. Well, however you explain it, there is this tendency. That's part of it. The other, I think, was when the Christian community, after the early 300s,
mm-hmm.
when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, when religion gets too tightly bound with any nation or political system, it tends to do what that nation does, namely assert that it is best and it tries to be dominant over others. And that's the blight of all religions. whether it's Christianity or even Buddhism, which is supposed to be free of all of these kind of contaminations. And we see when Buddhism gets too tightly connected with any government, with yep. any nation state, as we are seeing now in Myanmar, to the disgrace to the chagrin, to the embarrassment of Buddhists, you know, how Buddhist monks are now taking the political line of the generals, you know. Anyway, that's also part of it, where we didn't want to put down others and consider our it's the question of supremacy, you know. I mean, the supremacy of one nation over others, supremacy of one religion over others, we look down. But that is diametrically opposed, it seems to me, to the message of this Jesus whom we call Lord and teacher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It just never...
That's why, as good old Luther put it, Ecclesia Semper Reformanda, the church is in constant need of reformation.
Yeah.
Constant. We never get beyond the need for reformation.
You know, interestingly enough,
that's why
I love how you said that it's diving deeper into the teachings of Jesus and, you know, the gospels and things like that, that actually made you start to think those things. I think a lot of the people that have been on this podcast or even listen to this podcast, and myself included, when you take your inherited blinders off and you become aware of bias and you become aware of, you know, the pull of what you were being told you had to think, and you actually just engage with the text, you start to realize things like, boy, Jesus was really never bad-mouthing any other cultures. He was actually a prophet inside of his own. It was the people that thought they had it that he was constantly throwing off.
The people he got tough with were the religious leaders.
Right. Oh, it's so rewarding to see him always going, no, that's not. I love it.
Yeah. But as you say, John D.D., you know, and just to go back to the Gospels and read it with, you know, with fresh eyes, but I mean, to do that even more effectively or deeply, to do it with others who are also trying to look at it with fresh eyes, so that you can read the Gospels together, you know, and hear each other's insights and such. That's why we still need community,
absolutely,
all the time. Mm-hmm.
So as we're drawing to a close here, I thought I'd ask you one final question. And as we find ourselves in rather strange times, specifically in the United States right now, specifically when it comes to relations between religions and kind of this thing where we seem to buy into this idea of this propaganda of fear, and it seems almost like we feel like it's safer to stay within our gated communities instead of getting out into community and engaging the other. How do we and again, Adam and I have tried to do our small part. We did a series this year where we brought on guests. We had a Muslim guest. We had a Hindu priestess. Mm-hmm. We had on. We had a Jewish rabbi, and had some wonderful conversations. Just tried to not just engage them in conversation and teach folks a little bit about those individual religions, so to gain a better understanding. But just to I think bring about a conversation that shows that these are real people just like us who happen to be involved in other religions. So how do we foster a conversation? How do we encourage people to get out and engage in dialogue? What does that look like?
There's
of course different ways to answer that question and different ways of approaching it. But I would see kind of two ways of inviting, and now let's just talk to our fellow Christians right now, of inviting our fellow Christians to get to know followers of other religions and get to know other spiritualities. One would be the more ethical invitation, and the other would be the more spiritual. And by the ethical invitation would be that, hey, now just speaking especially to the context in the United States, but not only, we all have shared problems. We all have difficulties that we are engaging, that we're worried about for our children? How are we, you know, in terms of economic well-being, in terms of violence in our neighborhoods, in terms of the homeless in our neighborhoods, and in terms especially of some of the environmental questions in our neighborhoods and cities and towns? These are problems that can much better be addressed together than separately. So it's kind of the ethical issues, the issues of what are we going to do about violence and poverty and now the conflict among religions, and that we're hearing to a great extent even from our own, from our government now, you know, calling upon us to hate Muslims. How can we engage these problems? And let's come together, maybe to begin not to talk about what we believe, but what we're worried about. What we're all worried about together, and start acting together and form friendships.
Yeah.
Form friendships from working together. And once you start forming friendships, once you like that Muslim, or you once you really appreciate that Hindu, once you want to sit down and have a beer. Well, you don't want to have a beer with a Muslim. But because they're not allowed to have drink there. But once you want to have it, invite them over for a party or just for coffee, that's when dialogue starts. And the second invitation, as I said, is more spiritual, is just to give people an opportunity, and maybe you were doing some of this in your podcast, to realize that we can discover more of the reality of God trying to learn from other religions, by exploring what are some of their practices, what are some of their forms of prayer and meditation, what God means for them, so that ways of deepening our own spirituality. There's a richness, there's a real richness there that that it can be explored, through this kind of a spiritual conversation. As one theologian from my generation, or actually before my generation, Edward Skilabek put it, there is more truth in many religions than there can be in any one religion. So we can explore that truth, that spiritual truth, through these kind of spiritual dialogues, where we come together to share each other's forms of prayer, as I said, and meditation. I think, and once people get a sense of, oh my, these forms of Buddhist meditation I can use in my own spiritual Christian practice, this can open up doors as well. Mm. So, but, there are many different ways, and let's let each of us do whatever he or she can.
Well, I just want to thank you. I just want to thank you for not only sharing all these insights with us, but... I hope it doesn't sound funny to just say, you can just tell you're just being so true to yourself. You're so passionate, and you're so being true to what you know you're being called to do in your heart. And that just comes through in spades listening to you talk about all this.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. We're all trying in our different ways, but this is something, you get it. I got it from way back in grammar school it's a love of this Jesus and taking him seriously. He has just pushed me to take other religions seriously too as well. So it's been a pleasure talking with you and an inspiration.
Oh.
I'm 78 now, and I'm on my on my way out to know that there are other younger people carrying on as you two are, and so many others. It's a real inspiration and satisfaction for me. So I very much appreciate this opportunity.
Oh,
I'm grateful.
It was absolute honor for us, and I can't thank you enough. And I just want to tell people, encourage them who are listening to go out and pick up your books. No Other Name, Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian, Introducing Theologies of Religions, which was the first book that really got me into your work. It's vital. The work that you're doing and those like you. And again, I just appreciate you coming on the show. It's been an absolute honor for us.
Thank you.
Wait and watch the fire die.
gosh, dude. I already want to have him back on.
I know. It kind of reminded me of, I mean, maybe it's the parallel with the fact that he studied under Rahner. It reminds me of when we were talking to Rabbi Art Green, and he's like, yeah, I studied under Heschel. And
yeah,
we were like,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, yeah. Abraham Joshua Heschel was cool. my mentor.
Cool.
All through school.
Yeah.
What did you just say?
Pardon me? and we didn't mention this in the intro, but like Karl Rahner, if you guys don't know who he is, he was one of the pioneer architects behind Vatican II. I mean, he wrote a ton of that material.
Which overhauled
helped.
A lot of teachings within Catholicism and a lot of like what they were willing to consider and do. And if you want a summary of that, you can get it online. But I mean, we're talking like groundbreaking stuff. Vatican II is a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still is a big deal.
Huge.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's such a cool honor to be able to interview people like this and, yeah. And just to introduce people, cause Nitter, you know, like you said, the intro is not probably one of the more well-known names, you know, beyond like us theology nerds.
No, because he doesn't write like a ton of pop stuff.
Right. Cause like, that's a textbook right there.
Right. Like the book that we really used as our, you know, our skeleton for this interview is this book called No Other Name, which didn't you have to do this for one of your Fuller classes? Isn't that where you figured this guy out?
Not that one. I actually did his Theology of Religions book.
That's right. That's yeah. right. And then they sent us this yep. and we were like, whoa, yeah, this is really good. So it's more of an academic book, but it's called No Other Name. I'm Ron Burgundy. No Other Name. A critical survey of Christian attitudes toward world religions. And like, come on guys, if you have grown up in America, I don't even care if you grew up Christian, but like, religious attitudes and specifically Christian attitudes, because Christianity is the dominant religion in the U.S. and always has been, is kind of a big topic of conversation. Like, what's going on there? Do Christians hate Muslims? Christians hate Buddhists? We know Christians already hate each other. So
I was just going to say.
but then, you know, subtext behind all that, like, can you believe different things and still within, you know, Christian perspective, be okay, be saved, whatever that means. And language is really tricky, but surveying those questions is a really, really important thing for compassionate, thoughtful, deconstructing listeners to learn how to do. And there's no better guide alive right now, really, for that conversation than Paul Nitter.
Yeah.
Paul freaking Nitter.
I mean, he's really one of the last guys left that helped pioneer those different models. Like most of the people behind the other models, if you look in any of the Theology of Religions, textbooks, most of those guys are dead now. So like he's really the only living guy left. And like he talks about in the interview, you know, he kind of took what Rahner had kind of started and took it a step further.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, yeah, it was good, but it wasn't enough.
Yeah, it's like what students do, right?
Yeah.
It's like what students always do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we just owe him a debt of gratitude. I mean, what a great guy. We got to have him back on again. I'd like to get him on at a latter point just to talk about his story a little bit more, which he dives into in great detail in his book, Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian. And guys, I just cannot encourage you enough to pick that up. Whether you're interested in Buddhism or not, the model that he lays out for some of the questions that he asked as a theologian, as a young man, as somebody coming of age in his faith, and how he went through those questions and the language problem and all these kinds of things. It is it's amazing. Did you know I emailed him? I emailed him.
I'm not surprised.
I was about halfway through the book. And I was like, dude, your book is making me just like weep. I mean, it is so nailing me to the wall and offering me so much hope and optimism and beauty and compassion and inclusiveness and wisdom that it's just, thank you. And he wrote me right back, like within 20 minutes. He's like, you have no idea with how much that means to me. Like knowing that my work helps another like individual in their faith is like the highest compliment. And like, I was just getting my extrovert on, man. Like, you know me.
Yeah. I have to tell somebody. Let me share this with you.
Yeah. Just a great guy. And what a joy to have him on. So
I think that's a testament though, to one of the things that we've tried to do over the last year in our podcast, which is to, open up dialogue between other religions.
Yeah.
And specifically like the focal point of this kind of curiosity that we have, or this project that we've been conducting, is just get to people to open up enough to gain a little more understanding. And mm-hmm. I think you find that once you seek to understand, then some of the walls start to crumble a little. And it starts to, you start to see that the bigger picture maybe in a way.
You're like, oh, that's not that diff. That sounds so similar to,
Yeah.
Wow, this is amazing. And then like what he does in the book, because I really want to plug this thing. We're not getting any commission on it or anything like that. But like it's just that good. What he does is he starts off with problems in every chapter. He uses this model. He starts off with kind of like a problem or a question that he has trouble with in his Christian faith. And then he does what he calls passing over into like, how would Buddhists look at this? Like, how would Buddhists look at this? These concepts, how they, you know, interrelate and like resolve or, what is their kind of theory or answer or whatever on this? And then he takes that and he comes back into his Christian identity and he sees how it can interface and how it can expand and give room for either him to struggle or for him to look at things differently or whatever. And it's just, it's so good.
And I just double checked, but for those of you who have joined our Patreon book club, we're sending that one out.
Oh, are we sending this one out?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. I didn't even know that.
I couldn't remember which one we had picked, and I was like, Adam had... Now, that's one I have not read yet.
So good.
And I was a big Knitter fan to begin with, and Adam just like sealed the deal on it. So
the Knitter bug.
So this one's probably the most accessible. Because he writes a lot of the other books he has are definitely used in curriculum at seminaries and colleges and stuff like that. So I think this one's probably his most accessible. So those of you who are part of the book club, look for that coming. This month, or you may have already gotten it by now.
Yep.
We'll see.
It is just so good. He says in the first page, to leave the familiar, to move into the unknown, and to become something we weren't can be scary and demanding. If this is true of life in general, it should also be true of religious faith.
Boom.
Yeah, there you go. You guys are going to love this book, and we can't wait to come to Denver.
Yeah.
Thank you for everybody that is donating on Patreon, making all of this possible.
Ooh.
Putting steam in our engine. What do you got?
Quick note on that one. As far as the Patreon orders go, for those of you that have stuff coming to you, merch or whatever, especially the folks who signed up for the package that involves t-shirts, I try to respond to everybody or send messages through the Patreon website so as not to get mixed up with our regular inflow of emails. So if you haven't gotten a t-shirt yet, I've probably emailed you. So go to check your inbox, your messages on Patreon, and definitely let me know which t-shirt you want. We've got some new designs up on the website. We've got actually technically three new designs up there. They don't show up on the website until you click on the link that goes to our store.
It's good stuff.
But you can pick any t-shirt you want on there. Just let me know which t-shirt design and size, and I will make sure that ships out. If you haven't gotten something that you were supposed to by now, please let me know, and I'll definitely make sure that gets shipped out as well. So,
yep. And then for those of you that are looking forward to doing some live conversations with us that'll be recorded and used for other purposes, still kind of working out the schedule on that. We're trying to get this live show under our belt and things like that, but that is coming as well.
Good times.
What music is this, by the way?
Oh, crap.
Love it when you do that.
I know the answer to this.
One moment, please.
Now's the time of the show where Adam randomly talks about something while I look this up.
Yeah, I you just got me Spotify.
Oh yeah,
because you helped a brother out and got me on Spotify, and I was in the dark on that, and now I'm not. I see the light, and I'm following our playlist now. And thank you for updating that, because now I feel like I get to re-listen to all this sweet music, not just in like our episodes.
And
it's fantastic. And we have a lot of followers on there now.
Yeah, we have a few hundred on there.
Yeah, it's like ramping up, man. People are digging the Spotify. I didn't know this was like a thing, man. I'm like an old guy.
Dude, Spotify, like nothing against Apple. I love Apple and I own tons of Apple products. We use those to record on even and all their wonderful software. But I had Apple Music for a while and... I had Spotify before, and the Spotify, like, it's so user-friendly.
It's so good, man.
You can just get down a rabbit hole on that thing. But
and the music catalog is sick.
Oh, my gosh.
They have everything.
So, yeah, and it's super easy. So we started the playlist for the podcast. It's super easy. You just you type in under search, just type in our name, the Deconstructionist Podcast. Our playlist comes up. You can follow it. I update it every web.
And the episode. D is in brackets.
Yes.
Just in case you're wondering.
I don't think you have to type that in though.
You don't, but like when you're scrolling, if you don't just like notice that, if you're looking for the normal word, like, you know.
Another band pops up.
Right. So yeah, some band. But this music that is on this episode today, which is
Anadel. And if I remember correctly, I need to look because I'm like just working on 15 things at once. But I believe this is a band that is comprised of listeners of the show. So it's another situation where we had
sweet,
super cool music. And and they reached out to us. So likewise, actually, before I forget, if there's any musicians in Denver, local musicians who are interested in having their music on the show and or possibly working or playing our event, please email us at deconstructionistpodcast@gmail.com.
Let's talk.
Let's talk. We need one extra musician, potentially.
Maybe.
Maybe.
We're not sure.
So let us. So send us an email along with some of your tunes, and we can talk.
Yes.
From there.
Let's talk, and then let's talk live.
Yes.
In Denver.
And hug.
Oh man, we're so stoked, guys. We love you, and we do it all for you.
We do.
And that's it.
Yeah.
It was a fun episode with a lot of announcements. And
yeah.
Now I have to find a way to calm down and go to sleep. All right, guys. That's it for now. Thank you for tuning in. We are your hosts. I'm Adam Narlock.
And I'm John Williamson.
Keep deconstructing, everybody.
We're one step away. One step away from the edge, and we're running. We're one step away, digging the dirt for some gold while we're running. Bye.
father. Existence itself.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.